All right, time for another podcast. But before we get to this week's episode, let me tell you something. When I do these interviews, I usually interview the person and record an introduction and what they call an outro, which is the thing at the end, separately. And I like to talk about stuff that's going on. And I had an idea for something, and I typed it into my computer, my MacBook Air, and then I saved it in Documents, and I searched for it for 25 minutes, and it's not in there. And I'm telling you, I know that it's in there. And I turned it off, and I restarted it. I turned it upside down. I swore at it 14 times. Nothing worked. So I don't know what Apple's doing. Okay, it's that. And then I may have mentioned this before. I called Apple one day. I had a problem with another part of my computer. And they said, you got to go into the store or call the store. I said, okay, I'll call them. Can you transfer me? The woman says, no. I go, what, you don't want to? She goes, no, I can't. I go, what do you mean? She goes, we don't have the technology. They don't have the technology. It's Apple. It's Apple. Okay? Listen, it's real simple. I don't want to spend 25 minutes looking for a document. Okay? I'm not talking about the thing I wanted to talk about because I got to talk about this now. So here's what's going to happen. Tomorrow around noon, you're going to see breaking news on CNN and all those stations. Because I'm going down to the Apple store, 59th and 5th Avenue, and I'm taking a huge dump on a MacBook Air, and then I'm going to walk it over to a Genius Bar there, and I'm going to say to one of the geniuses, fix that. Okay, I feel a little better. All right, this week, we have a best of episode. Tommy Chong, a great stoner comedian, Mick Foley, great wrestler, and Dr. Drew, great, great doctor. Everybody's great on this. And that's why I wanted to do a best of, because they were all really interesting interviews in their own right. All of really guys who, you know, have achieved some really cool stuff. And I thought you should get to know them and hear them. And I figured, you know, if somebody likes Tommy Chong, they may not listen to Dr. Drew or Mick Foley. Or somebody listens to Mick Foley may not listen to Tommy Chong or Dr. Drew. And one of the points of this podcast is to get people to hear things or from people that they don't normally read or hear or watch on interviews and stuff. So listen to the whole thing. If you're a Tommy Chong, Mick Foley, or Dr. Drew fan, if you're not any of them, still listen to the whole thing because all three are really cool, really interesting conversations. Thanks again for checking the podcast out. And please, if you haven't done so, I know I repeat myself on this, but it's important. Please go leave some comments about the podcast on iTunes. It always helps. All right. Enjoy the best of. You had a number 29 on the U.S. pop chart list hit song, Does Your Mama Know About Me? Because you, you were part of Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers, signed with Motown Records. You were like a serious deal musician out of Canada. Talk about that and how that came about.
Well, we were the first non-black group. I won't say white because I'm half Chinese.
Right.
So we were the first non-white group to sign with Motown in 60, I think it was 66, I think we signed with them. What happened is that we were playing in an after-hours club in Vancouver, Canada, owned by my family. You know, it was a Chong-owned nightclub. Mm-hmm. And we got discovered by Diana Ross, of all people. Diana Ross and the Supremes came down to the club one night and saw us.
Wow.
Diana Ross was having a little thing with Barry at the time, and so she called Barry, and Barry Gordy flew out to from Detroit and listened to us, heard us, and signed us up. Wow. And then probably forgot about us.
Wait, why? What, because you were in Canada and not in Detroit or L.A. or New York and you needed to be?
Well, I think he just wanted some of Diana Ross, you know. And if he had to sign us, well, that was like part of the deal, you know.
anything to keep the blowjobs coming, right?
Yeah, exactly. So then we waited, you know, we were so happy, we celebrated and everything. And then we waited for, you know, a couple of days and a couple of weeks. And then Bobby Taylor, he's like from New York. He's an old hard, battle hardened R&B singer.
Right.
He said, oh man, let's just go to Detroit. And so we gigged our way over to Detroit. We played in Seattle, then we played in Los Angeles, and then we flew from Los Angeles to Detroit and met with Berry Gordy and recorded the song. Mm. And then in the process of recording, after we had the hit, mm-hmm. we were on the road and we met a little group that won a contest. And they were opening for us. We were opening for Jerry Butler, mm-hmm. this unknown group. had this little guy who could really sing and dance. Yeah. They were called the Jackson Five.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. And so we discovered them. And we, Bobby Taylor, again, he, you know, he took the initiative. He said, come on, guys, you can stay at my house. But he had an apartment.
Yeah.
And so the Jackson Five stayed at Bobby's house or apartment for close to a month.
Wow.
And then Berry Gordy, you know, heard him and signed him. And the little known fact is that I was the only non-white guy that the Jackson Five knew, Joe Jackson. And so they brought me the contract to look over for them.
Because you were the non-white guy in the group.
Yeah. I'm the only guy that looked like a lawyer, you know.
So was the dad traveling with them at the time? Was it the oldest one had to be just a teenager, right?
Yeah, the oldest one was Jackie was the tallest.
Yeah.
And the oldest, and Michael was about eight years old then.
Wow.
And and so Joe was traveling with him. And so when we got there, Joe was with him in Chicago. We played with him in Chicago. And then, then when he brought the contract to me, you know, I said, well, you know, they'd signed him up for 7 years. And I said, it'd be a good place to go to school for the boys, you know, because Motown had a school at the time. You know, for all their entertainers. And so that's where Michael really learned how to dance and sing and present himself.
Did you see the raw talent there at eight? Did you see?
Yeah. Oh, my. Yeah. I mean, it was there. I mean, he sang My Girl, mm-hmm. the Temptations song.
Yeah.
He sang it. He did a number on it.
And, sang it very soulfully, and as though like he were an old soul in a way, right?
Yeah, well, he had that ear. He could hear everything. Bobby Taylor had the same talent. Mm-hmm. In fact, Bobby ended up producing their first album.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, that was a payback for bringing the Jackson Five. We got to work for Berry Gordy some more.
How did you come to be with Bobby Taylor? How did that come about? Because I know you were like you were in a band called Tight Shades. You were in a band called Four Niggers and a Chick, which
that's part of Bobby's. That was Bobby Taylor's group too.
Because you were doing okay in school, and you dropped out of school, and you're like, hey, the musicians get chicks. This seems like a good deal. Like, how did music come into your life?
Well, music, actually, that's where pop came into my life, because I was struggling with school. I had quit school in grade 10. It was too hard. And right. And then when I became a roofer almost a year.
That is a hard job, man. That is.
Hey, that got my ass back in school, I'll tell you.
So you don't want to do that when you're high either. That's the one job you don't want to be stoned doing.
No. Except when you put your foot into the hot bucket, then painkillers is good. No, and then I went back to school and I managed to get grade 10, I got grade 11, and I was working on the last grade, and then I couldn't make it. Mm-hmm. No, I got high. Someone turned me on to pot.
In the 11th grade?
Yeah, in my 11th grade. And then this is like, I was always oldest in my class. So now I'm twice as old. You know, I'm two semesters older than everybody else. Mm-hmm. And so then I smoked pot for the first time and listened to a Lenny Bruce record. And that did it. That was like, okay, I just want to be a blues musician. And I just wanted to get on the road with the band. That's all I wanted to do, play music.
What was it about Lenny Bruce? I know you, in reading about you, you had said that, you know, he was talking about pot and legalizing pot in the 60s. Was it that, or was there something in the, was, did you?
Oh, no, it was the freedom that he had. He was talking about, you know, really taboo subjects. You know, one of his funniest bits was Governor of Orville Faubus, you know, the racist governor of Mississippi, mm-hmm. he's talking about Lenny's having an imaginary conversation with the daughter. Mm-hmm. The daughter and Orville Fava's there talking. And she's, Daddy, I met this beautiful Italian boy. His name is Harry Belafonte. Oh, he's Italian.
That was that ability to kind of say whatever you wanted to say. But you were still interested in music. That wasn't the bug that bit you to do comedy, right? You were just,
not at all. No. I just loved comedy. Mm. And the other connection to comedy was with Red Fox. Because when we were in Detroit struggling with Motown, you know, doing our first album, Red Fox came to the 20 Grand, the little club in Detroit. And I seen genius there. I seen Fox did two hours, man. And he took him up. The first hour, he took him right up to the point you were laughing so hard you were hurting yourself. Mm-hmm. And then he took you down. He made people so disgusted they ran out of the club.
You mean like got really blue or got controversial?
Got really blue. He just turned that. He took that crowd and he turned them, literally turned them against him.
Why do you think he would do something like that?
Because he's got he had the power. The power to do it. He's the only comedian I've ever seen do it on purpose.
Really? Yeah.
Like he lost him to the point that they were running out of the door and Red Fox had opened the door for them. He went to the door. Thanks for coming, y'all. You know, drive carefully now. Okay, now let's. And he went, walked back on stage and did and brought the crowd right back up.
So
he had that ability.
You're a musician at the time with no plans of being a comedian or doing comedy. But there's clearly something about comedy that's grabbing you. What is it that's intriguing at this stage of your life? This is the 60s and you're 20.
My late 20s.
Okay. What is it that's grabbing you about comedy, do you think, at that point in your life? Because you're not thinking about doing comedy, but you obviously.
No. It was just, when I got into the blues, I got into jazz. In fact, the band that I quit school for had a sax player that was really a piano player. He went on to become the Dick Ken Cheney Experience in Chicago, and I played bass while he played his jazz piano. So I got a taste of jazz real early. And so I really became a jazz musician, not a very good one, you know, technically, but I understood the world. And jazz and comedy are exactly alike.
I think so too. Explain to me why you feel that way.
Well, because it's free form. You take a subject and then you play with it.
Right.
But you come back to the theme or the subject, you know, but you can take any subject and like any chord structure, and then you mess with it and you play with it. And then like you might play the fast song real slow or real slow song real fast.
Right.
And it's all done from the heart. And so and every jazz musician I ever met always had a joke. Always had their one joke that would make you cry so hard that snot would come out of your nose. You know, that kind of feel. And they always had the perfect timing. Like that's who Red Fox would hang with. He would hang with musicians because they were the best comedians. You know, they weren't another comedian waiting for everybody to shut up so he can do his bit.
Yeah,
they were guys that were riffing as they went along, you know. Yeah. And then the band itself, Bobby Taylor is very funny. He's a very funny guy. He was between him and I, we come up with the name of the four. It was a bet. We said,
did anybody sit around and go, this might be a problem. Like, that is the most ballsy name I've ever heard in my life. And you went out for a while, but then you had to change it to the four N's and the C's, right?
Well, what happened? we thought, oh, that's funny. So we owned the club at the time.
Yeah.
And what happened in Canada, in Vancouver, these club owners would buy the building and they would have nobody to run the club, you know, to make it successful because it was very hard. And so then we got offered clubs all the time because we had a band. And so we got offered the first club, the After Hours Club, downstairs from a ballroom. Mm-hmm. And the ballroom had a history of not doing business, you know, losing business. The ballroom, which was called the Retinal Circus, once booked the Stones, Rolling Stones, and lost money.
What?
Yes.
Was this before 64? When would this be that they lost money on
this? This was in the late, it was in the 60s. It was before, it was before we got signed with Motown. So it had to be around, 60. Anyway, it was in mid 60s.
Before they became the Stones that we know today.
Well, the Stones were, you know, they had that little hit. They had that, the initial hit.
Yeah.
And then touring and they had lost, you know, they were going from, you know, from venue to venue to venue, and they happened to stop at this one, and they happened to come at the same time James Brown was playing, and Vancouver was and probably still is a bit historically rhythm and blues town. Mm-hmm. And so when the Stones went up against the James Brown, and James Brown's playing in the big arena, you know, and so everybody went to see James Brown, and a handful of people went to see the Stones. And James Brown's band came down to the club. Our club was the only place opened after they finished their gig, and it was where they could, find chicks hanging out. Yeah. And so James Brown's band came down, and we were playing on stage. There was about 12 of us on this little ass stage. And the club was packed. And I looked in the back and I could see the entrance and I could see Keith Richards and Ronnie, was it Ronnie Scott? Is that his name?
Ronnie Wood.
Ronnie Woods in the back waving at me, trying to get my attention so I'd get him in. But the club was so packed, I couldn't do anything. And my brother didn't know who the Stones were.
Jesus, that's going to go on your gravestone. Like, couldn't get the Stones into a club. That's unbelievable. That's the greatest story ever.
They got turned away, man.
But how did you come? Did you come to know them just from them coming into town and playing that your club, your dad, your family's club? Is that how you got to know the Stones personally?
No. We didn't. I didn't meet the Stones until Cheech and I opened for them. The Nicaragua benefit that Mick had.
Oh, okay.
For his then wife or girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And they played at the Forum, and Lou Adler, who was our manager at the time, got us the gig to open for them. And so the Cheech and Chong opened for the Stones at that gig. Oh. And it was that was the first time we played in front of L.A., in front of 16 or 17,000 people. Mm. And that's when we found out that comedy works in the huge venues.
Yeah. Well, up to that point, you were doing, you know, like theaters, like 1,000, 2,000 seats.
Well, not even that. We were doing little clubs, little folk clubs, like the Troubadour.
Right.
And little clubs all over the place. But we had a record out. And so when we went on and did our bit, I mean, the crowd just ate us up. And that was the only time that I met the Stones and Keith. We never really hung together at all, you know. He liked a different brand of dope than I did.
The story is that you hitchhiked to Madison Square Garden to see Jimmy Snuka in a handicap match against Don Morocco.
And that's
kind of where you fell in love with it. And you went to high school with Kevin James, and you were a wrestler.
Did, yep.
You were on the wrestling team. Now, did you see yourself maybe going, being a Greco-Roman wrestler and going to like the Olympics, or did you know?
No, because I was a huge pro wrestling fan, and to this day,
Bruno Sammartino. Did you like Bruno Sammartino?
Yeah, I like Bruno growing up. To this day, it's hard for me to fathom that Bruno actually likes me. You know, our styles were so different.
I think.
But yeah, I did. I went out for the team, and if someone had stopped me and said, "Hey, you know that Kevin James is the heavyweight," like I probably would have. Oh yeah, going out for that team would not be a good idea because Kevin was a tough kid and one of only two guys at our high school who bench pressed 300 pounds.
Wow!
And I was definitely not that other guy.
Right.
But once I got in there and realized that I could hang with Kevin, you know, and that we wrestled, you know, every day as, you know, friends and, but also mm-hmm. as, you know, partners and opponents, I was like, wow, man, like maybe I'm capable of doing more than I thought. And all of a sudden this dream of being a professional wrestler became something I decided that I, you know, could follow.
Oh, so when you went to Madison Square Garden, you had it in your mind that you probably wanted to try pro wrestling, or did that visit trigger?
Well, I was a huge fan. Like, you know, as a comic, I think everyone's got like that moment where they realize this is exactly what I want to do.
Yeah.
For me, as a wrestling fan, you know, when Snuka came off the top of that cage, and you know, I the phrase I use in my book is, you know, it was like the most impressive sight I'd ever seen. He's standing up there in that cage and he's barefoot. And it says, you know, his body was bathed in both blood and flash bulbs. And he took off, you know, it wasn't 15, you know, it's amazing the power of repetition. Like that 15 foot high steel cage, you go back and it's like, it's only a foot taller than he is, you know, like, but it was the majesty of the moment. And I had hitchhiked, you know, and I was by myself, you know, sitting in the sixth or seventh row.
So you're 17, 18 at the time?
I was 18.
Wow.
18. And yet when he dove off, it was like I was part of something bigger than myself, like part of a community. And I remember like vividly thinking like, one day I'd like to make people feel the way that I feel right now. And
yeah,
that was the goal. Like, and that without that moment at the Garden, you know, so many things, if, you know, hadn't been for going out for that team and going against the mighty Kevin James or that hitchhiking experience to the Garden, you know, none of what followed would have taken place.
Well, you followed your passion, you know. I mean, I was a lawyer and a banker before I did this, and I left to be a comedian, and it was a tough choice. But, like, I think it kind of picks you. It sounds like it picked you anyway, you know what I mean? Like, it was, like you said, it was bigger than – the moment was bigger than just the moment. And when that happens, like – you're kind of sucked in whether you want to be or not, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I'd kind of given up on it. On the storytelling and the comedy. And the worst thing that could have happened to me was that I tried to become a comic, you know, and
right.
I tried to, instead of being the, you know, the storyteller, I was like, okay, I got to study from these guys. And I had a set that was so painful. I mean, it hurt.
Wait. You're talking about doing stand up or wrestling?
When I did stand up, when I segued into stand up.
Oh, out of wrestling. Know, like, oh, okay, gotcha.
4.5 years ago, and yeah. I was going with the Wounded Warriors. I was accompanying them, and mm-hmm. I told the guy, we're at the Gotham Comedy Club in New York, and I told the guy with the Warriors, I said, "Hey, I used to do, you know, some stand up. If you guys want me to do a set, let me know." And I'm sitting there at the front table, you know, and then I didn't know Amy Schumer at the time, but she came out, acknowledged me. So that when I met her in Montreal a couple of years later, she's like, I saw you in the front row of the Gotham. But you know, the way these showcases are, like, you don't get on these showcases unless you're really good to begin with.
Yeah.
And so Amy comes out and she kills. And then, you know, this guy is good, this guy. And then Judah comes out. You know, Judah does the killer 20 minutes. And then they go, "Hey, we have a special guest." You know, like, he's here supporting the Wounded Warriors, WWE champion Mick Foley. And I go up thinking it's going to be like a wrestling promo that I can wing.
Yeah.
And people were not buying what I thought, you know, I had to sell.
Right.
And at a certain point, I just said to the audience, I just said, if I was in a pool, I'd ask for a life preserver because I'm drowning up here.
And
I walked out of that stage fall. I was like, I never want to go through this again. And Judah was there.
Mm.
And he goes, "Dude, He goes, it's not as bad as you thought. I said, Judah, come on. It's awful. He goes, dude, ordinarily, if someone goes four straight minutes without getting a laugh, he goes, they're done. He goes, but dude, they'll listen to you. He goes, don't get me wrong. You got to find ways to make these stories funny.
Yeah.
But he kind of talked me like off the ledge, you know. And
plus you've got your audience coming to you who are wrestling fans now, as opposed to that situation.
Now,
that situation was a bunch of
different
civilians who probably weren't necessarily pro wrestling fans per se.
Yeah. And I was trying. I mean, I had some really overarching themes. And what's funny is that when the show ended up, and it did become a pretty good show, took it to Edinburgh and Montreal, that a lot of what ended up working was stuff that I threw out there, you know, as a premise that night at Gotham. And I love it. It reminds me so much of being in the ring and wrestling or when I was writing. Is like you come up with an idea and you don't know where it's going to end up, you know, or how you're going to use it, but you have this idea. And then when it clicks, boom, it's like, you know, it locks into place and, you know, you get that laugh kind of
off the
cuff.
Yeah. Talk about sort of, I'm fascinated because I had this conversation with Stone Cold on the podcast about there are a lot of parallels between what stand-ups do to develop and hone and define their persona and what wrestlers do and how you walked into the business at a young age. And, you know, you've had incarnations as, you know, Mankind and Dude Love and Cactus Jack. And like, how did you hit on these different personas at the different stages of your career? And when did you decide to transit and why transition away from one to the other and back to one? You sometimes would bring them back.
Yeah. I'm going to try to handle this. There are similarities. I'd say one of the big similarities is I've been really fortunate that when other comics see me, you know, they might be skeptical. And I've heard this from guys, like they're skeptical because there've been those, you know, those guys who were just using their time on stage.
I hear you, but I'm not talking about your show right now. I'm talking, I mean, we could talk about that too, but I'm talking about like how that percent.
Well, what I was going to say is there's that weeding out process where guys are offering advice and you have to take what works for you, cipher it out, you know, and you decipher it and figure out, okay, how is this working for me? And when I got to WWE, I'd been Cactus Jack for 11 and a half years. So, mm-hmm. you know, in the beginning, I'd always wanted to be this wrestler called Dude Love. Mm. And Cactus Jack was supposed to be a generic name I would use until I became good enough to adopt the moniker Dude Love, and I would become the ladies' man and essentially, you know, be able to like live out a fan, you know, kind of play a character that was completely against my, I'd be like, you know, living out a fantasy. And then, as it turned out, like Mother Nature didn't quite cooperate with the Dude Love thing. And I became really comfortable and over the years, you know, really good at being this, you know, deranged Cactus Jack character.
Yeah, that's, and you talk about Tri-State Wrestling style of wrestling suited that character really well.
Man, you go back. Well, that's old school. Tri-State was the precursor to ECW.
Yeah, Extreme Championship Wrestling. And what was it? So people who don't understand wrestling, you know, the way real aficionados are, there are these sort of, it's almost if I'm doing this badly, tell me, but like these sort of minor league organizations that you work your way through to get to the big time, right? And as you're working through those organizations, you're defining kind of who your character is and you're playing and exploring and trying out, just like comedians try out bits with audiences, you're trying out moves and getting audience reactions and you're listening and then tweaking. Is that accurate? I mean, is that?
Yeah, that's really accurate. In the old days, the process was really cool. You know, it was different. Now there is, you know, more, you know, cooperation and mm-hmm. planning. But and I'm not saying that it was ever, you know, a true competitive thing. But, you know, when I went to Memphis, Tennessee, they were kind of tough on me, mm-hmm. I think because I was Northern. Like, mm-hmm. that sounds weird, but that's the conclusion I've reached. But at the same time, we'd wrestle in the same city, you know, every Monday night was Memphis, every Tuesday was Louisville, every Wednesday was Evansville, Indiana, every Saturday night was Nashville. Nashville, for example, you wouldn't even see your opponent until you got in the ring. So there was impossible to, you know, to plan anything. Mm-hmm. It kind of had to work on, you know, movement, you know, and feel. Same thing when you were in Japan and didn't speak the language, you know, you wouldn't, you know, I told my kids that maybe they were old enough to watch like my most physical,
yeah,
disturbing matches. A match I had, in Japan in January of 1999 with Terry Funk,
right,
with an N, in case there's any FCC issues.
Now you can say whatever you can really, say whatever you want on this. Don't worry about it.
Just really wild stuff. But when I got to WWE, when I finally got that call, you know, Mr. McMahon did not tell me the reason they were going for the character change is because he just always thought I looked seedy.
Mm-hmm. And he wanted.
And I did. Yeah. He didn't. I didn't have that star look.
When you really got into wrestling full time, what was the biggest eye opener? The physical demands. Did you think it was more show than it actually was? Was it more fake than it actually was?
Well, I found in a hurry. You know, well before I got on the road full time, that it was, you know, far more realistic than I'd ever imagined. You know, I thought I could take my flair for the theatrics. I didn't realize at the time that I would develop this, you know, threshold for pain. It was tough, and I was not a natural to it. You know, mm-hmm. I'd already committed, to taking this drive every weekend from my college in Cortland to, Pittsburgh, which is about 350 miles each way. And,
wow. That's,
you know,
a
right on the, yeah, it was a hike, right on the verge of calling it quits. You know, I finally started getting the hang of it, you know, and started finding out that, I could do things that I, you know, didn't think were possible. You know, I had, you know, more skills than I had.
What are we talking about? You mean in terms of just the physical demands and the moves and all of that? And are you getting trained from by somebody at this point?
Yeah. I was really fortunate. The guy who trained me, a guy named Dominic DiNucci, he'd qualified for the Italian Olympic team way back in the 50s, but didn't mm-hmm. have the money to go. And he was a guy, I remember when we went to Italy in 86, he was in his, you know, he was in his mid 50s then. And they had a big, thick Italian bodybuilder who wanted to train to be a wrestler. And Dominic said, he got in the referee's position for amateur wrestling. And he said, if you can turn me, I train you. And this guy, you know, I mean, he could have probably bench pressed 400 pounds or more. And it was like, it was amazing. You know, like, he could not get him off his base. And so if Dominic wanted to, and this was an old school thing, like in the Carolinas, some of the stuff they did is outright cruel. You have to keep in mind that there was this whole real versus fake debate. So
right.
Part of the way they instilled respect for pro wrestling is they would take a guy, okay, you're going to train to be a wrestler, and okay, get down in the referee's position. And as soon as he got down in the referee's position, they drop a knee on his ankle and break his leg immediately. And then that was thought to be good for business because the guy would return to wherever he was from with a cast. And they'd say, how did you get that? And it was, I mean, it's like, I
oh my God. So it was like advertising that this is
yeah,
real.
Yeah. Yeah. Like in the Florida territory, the prerequisite, you know, for a job was that you'd be able to get into fights in bars and win. So that was their free advertising, was the police blotter.
Wait. So that, like, you would have to go to a bar, get in a fight, beat a guy up, get arrested, and then you'd get a job?
And they would know that's how you kept your job and you kept your position of prominence. And there were, you know, stories about, you know, back then, one of the things I do on this, you know, my current show, the Hardcore Legend Tours, I examine the idea of getting heat from the crowd, how hard I had to work for it, because I was not a naturally mean person and not a naturally, like, not a natural alpha male even, you know, that I was more the guy who wanted the reactions. I was more of a performer. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, I was in a business where guys literally had to fight for their lives to get out of towns, you know, where it was considered, you know, I remember my first week in Texas, it was considered like a badge of honor to get your tires slashed by fans because that proved that you had teeth.
How are you as a patient being a doctor and all of that?
Apparently I'm good. I did a podcast at my own podcast. I have a Dr. Drew podcast at right. drdrew.com. And I had my doctor on, a guy mm-hmm. named Skip Holden. Mm-hmm. And he talked about it. He talked about what it was like treating him. Apparently I was good.
Yeah. Well, we should mention, by the way, host of the Dr. Drew podcast, as you did, host of Dr. Drew on call on HLN, 9 p.m. Eastern Time.
We're here at nights. CNN now.
Yes, exactly. Right in the Time Warner Center. Host of Loveline, of course. And we want to get the word out about the prostate and cancer awareness. One of the things that's sort of fascinating to me is that you had said in sort of the research that I sort of did on you that you're a non-observant Jew, in the sense of sort of your religion, you acknowledge religion, but as a scientist and so forth,
right.
That's sort of, that is not sort of your focus, if you will. At being a patient and sort of looking at, not that you were sort of on a death sentence, but did you sort of take stock of that?
Yeah.
Point of view a little
yeah.
bit.
Yeah, and the research, you know, human research shows that as we get older, we get more religious. And, right. and I'm no exception. so I have been more interested in the unknown as I've gotten older. You know, my wife's into her whole thing. You've done her podcast.
Yeah.
And that's all some intuitive world that women tune into. I don't know what the hell that is,
but
I'm open to the idea of our brain is very limited capacity. Right.
And for my listeners, what Dr. Drew's referring to, his wife Susan, who has her own podcast, is very much into the spiritual and the clairvoyance. Yeah. And they did a reading with me on her show, and I guess you've had a reading done.
I'm fascinated.
Do you believe in that?
I believe that women use a lot more of their right brain than men do, and they have much more access to it. And I don't like using terms like "do believe." It's just like, what's the evidence? Mm. The evidence is they're tapping into something. I think they're reading minds. I think they're tapping into something about us.
And they have a greater ability to do that.
They do. And these women probably have developed something. I know that when I'm in treatment with patients, I get in that right mind reading space.
Yeah.
It's a very magical space.
Yeah.
It's almost hypnotic and weirdly informed. It's weird. I mean, your body starts experiencing stuff you've never experienced before, and it's literally put there by the other person. Why couldn't some important person in my life be left behind in my cortex, and then I put I communicate it in some weird way to all that unknown stuff. I've become increasingly fascinated by. I was a pure scientist my whole life, and then now I'm becoming interested in the unknown.
What was it about religion? My father-in-law was an OBGYN, and we had this conversation. He's since passed, but he sort of was of that ilk too, of, you know, science is science, and that explained a lot of things for him. So what was that for you early on in your life, sort of? Religion is there, but that's not an explanation for a lot of things.
As some of the Catholics say, it's about how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. And I was more interested in how the heavens go. And Judaism does not really have much about afterlife. And I wasn't really interested in that. I thought Pascal's wager, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pascal's wager is that basically you. I can never state it right, but it's that if you gamble that there is no God and you're wrong, you've lost everything. And there is an afterlife and you've been...
Right.
I think he got the wager wrong. The wager is if you lived your whole life based on human-created anthropological imaginary concepts and sacrifice elements of the lived life, you've lost everything. You really lost everything. Now, Judaism doesn't do that kind of stuff to you. I was raised until third grade in Saturday school and stuff like that. And so I was, and we had an extended family that was very religious.
Mm-hmm.
I have always been very uncomfortable with the idea of inclusion and exclusion. Chosen and not chosen,
club
members and not club
it's
members,
a very quick
special
concept.
Languages and special. I've been since I was a kid uncomfortable with that. I don't like that.
Yeah,
and so that was what first sort of got me to push back.
Yeah, your father. Go ahead.
My father was
a doctor.
And his parents were. You know, his first language was Yiddish. My dad's first language. Wow. They're Russian, basically Russian. You know, Ukrainian. What's right next to Ukraine, down below? Belarusian immigrants, you know. And
was he very religious, or was it the same?
He was a scientist. Mm-hmm. I mean, he just was like, this was all nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Now, your mom, a singer, an actress, less, more of a sort of lean toward religion?
Less.
Yeah.
Zero.
Yeah.
I don't even know if she had an upbringing, religious upbringing. Yeah. So.
But you played Tevye in the high school.
But play. I did. But that's right. That's my room.
That was your tip of the hat.
The remainder of my religious training.
And did you? I know you sing, and I know you sing opera. Mm. Do you still do that?
I still like to do that. I do it so infrequently that I hate to even say that I still do that. but my son has really picked up that mantle, and he is a real musician. He mm-hmm. went to the conservatory and whatnot, and he is so far in outer space from where I was.
Is that right?
I just like hand it off. I do enjoy singing once in a while, though. I like it. I've got a good. I'm a terrible musician. I have a decent instrument. But that's what it boils down to.
Did you? Was there any interest sort of in seriously going into the arts?
Or
was
it
clearly science?
No. Oh, no. I did the whole, you know, after first year of college, you know, I went off to Amherst College mm-hmm. and pre-med, got my ass handed to me, and I got good grades, but... Oh my God! I was just depressed and overwhelmed, right. And I didn't know what I was doing or why.
I read
I was doing
somewhere
it.
Like at 19, you were having panic attacks at 19.
That was later. Once I got,
I hope that's okay. I'm saying that.
No, I don't mind. I have anxiety disorder now. I just don't have panic anymore.
Maybe I have it. What is that? How does it manifest itself for you?
Jones anxiety disorder.
Yeah.
I'm just more anxious than the average person, you know.
Just everything sort of rummages around in your brain.
When I literally, you know, it's hard to calm down, and I have lots of preoccupations, and you know,
a little OCD thing.
A little OCD, and anxiety and OCD kind of go together.
Yeah.
And I've channeled it and used it, but you know, it drives my wife crazy. Mm-hmm. It drives people around me crazy. But I'm like, let's go. Come on. Yeah, whatever it is we're doing.
Well, my nightmare is I get up at 4 or 5 in the morning and go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
And because I'm a comedian, I work at night.
Yeah.
And I drink a lot of liquids. Not necessarily booze, but you can drink it water, whatever, soda. And you're filled up, you know, more so than the average person.
Look, I do radio till midnight every night.
So you know, right?
And I have the same thing. Or I take coffee because I'm tired. And then that's it. Now I'm up at 4.
I get up and I cannot fall back to sleep because brain just starts going. And I got to do this. I got to do that. And then I start worrying about this. And then I'm reliving something I did 8 years ago. And, you know, I used to be a lawyer and investment banker on Wall Street. And I left to be a comedian. And it was that. And, you know, when you have you hit a bump in your career, you're like, did I do the right thing? And all of that. And it's sometimes hard to shut that down. Yeah. And I don't know if I'm describing what you're...
No, you have to try that anxiety. Yeah, you should know that that's not normal. that's not what you call normal. And all those intensive career moves and successes and things, not normal.
No, I know.
Yeah, it's all OCD and anxiety stuff. It serves you, right? It works for you.
Wait,
you can channel
the career
it.
The career move wasn't normal.
Well, it's either... No, not the career. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm just the your high intensity... Success driven.
Yes.
You know, that's either bipolar or anxiety.
Yeah.
You know, and or both or whatever. And it's okay. Yeah. You can chance how people get the stuff shit done. I mean,
yeah, I think it's a double edged sword. I do think that overachievers or whatever it is you want to call it, sort of, but there's a sort of side to that that you live with. But in your.
Well, it was out of control. So I drifted away. So I was like, fuck this. This is everybody. They wanted me to do this. I'm not going to do this. That's not me, man. Yeah. I'm going to go do whatever. And I left college for a while, and then I was depressed, so I went back, and I was like, oh crap, now what? And then I started having panic attacks, and it was horrific. Yeah. And they mistreated me so badly.
Was it they were giving you just medication?
No, they should have given me medication. They didn't even make an attempt at it. They told me to take a long walk in the woods. And I was like, dude, if I can make this stop by that, I fucking happily would.
And this is like 70s, 80s,
mid-70s. Yeah, mid-1977. And, you know, I go down to student health, and the guy's like, oh, I don't know, you just...
Walk it off.
Get it together, dude. You know, it's like,
seriously?
Oh, yeah. Some old time New England doctor was down there. Dude, this was his retirement work for the college. And they had no real student health.
Right.
The thing is how I got interested in adolescent health. Because when I started doing medicine, there was no focus on adolescence at all. Nobody. That's why I got on the radio. It was
in 84, and you were
HIV and AIDS really compelled me to go talk about it publicly. No one was talking to young people about it.
Right.
No one.
Right.
And then, you know, people were barely acknowledging that young adults and adolescents were having sex, let alone at risk for STDs or HIV. It just wasn't. Didn't happen. Adults did that, man. It's a sexual revolution was perpetrated by adults. They never imagined. that adolescents would pick that.
And this is the mid '80s we're talking about. This isn't like the this isn't the 1950s when our parents didn't talk about
the
sex.
Condoms were behind the counter. You had to ask. You had to line up at the pharmacy and get the pharmacist to get you the condom.
Right.
Remember?
Yeah. And this is '84 when you were a med student.
Yeah.
And you started an Ask a Surgeon, which is a Sunday night radio segment, which led to another segment, which led to your first regular hosting gig on radio. And your focus on Ask a Surgeon was just that, was information for adolescents?
Ask a Surgeon, when they described to me, when my friend first called me and said they wanted to do the segment called Ask a Surgeon, I was like, what in the hell are you? Oh, yeah, you use big words, it'll be really funny. I was like, no, come, please, don't be ridiculous. Well, they insisted, when I went up there, they insisted on calling it Ask a Surgeon, but it was STD and birth control advice. It was young adult. Yeah,
and was the radio now?
Same
show. Nobody's talking. Were they okay with? Was the radio okay with you talking about that content?
It was midnight to 3 a.m. Yeah, they needed community service. That's why they invited me, because they needed to make it a community service show.
Did you have any interest in public speaking or being a broadcaster or anything like that?
No, I never considered it. But I always was sort of drawn into what's going on. You know, radio, you got to remember, radio is influential to young people.
Yeah.
And I thought, man, it's not been so healthy in its impact. Maybe we can make it do something healthy here.
Right.
And I kind of asked guys, can I keep coming back? And we kept coming back once a week as a volunteer for 10 years. And if I was on call or something, I wouldn't come in.
You had something that you called a burning bush moment with Aurora Lessons and Sinesis, if I'm pronouncing it, I apologize.
Burning bush moment.
You said that I watched these young people go from dying to better than they ever knew they could be.
Yep.
And I was like, whoa. For me, addiction exposes all of the brain mechanisms under the influence of a profoundly distorted primary motivation.
All true. I didn't call it a burning bush moment. Somebody else
did. Yeah, somebody did. Yeah. Where was the turning point for you where you started to say, okay, I'm going to fixate's the wrong word, but sort of focus some of my efforts, or at least a significant part, on addiction and helping people with that dilemma? I lost, in the last 18 months, 3 friends to addiction, 2 to drug overdose and 1 to alcoholism.
Good times, huh?
Yeah.
I was always drifted to what I thought was the problem of the time, and it was HIV and AIDS for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working in a psychiatric hospital.
This is out of med school now.
I started moonlighting there. I was out of med school as a resident and moonlighting there. Then I ended up running their whole medical services. So mm-hmm. I became like really good at the medical treatment of psychiatric patients. I was mm-hmm. interested in psychiatry. If I hadn't done that, I probably would have gone on to become a cardiologist. This probably would have happened if I'd not gotten so interested in what was going on in psychiatry. Yeah. And but all the sick patients were drug addicts, and you know, and that's where I was asked to go do my medical thing. And also, I became very good at withdrawal, which was nothing that was ever taught as a discipline in medical school. And there was a guy down there.
That mean? You became good at it?
How getting people, you using medication to get people through.
So methadone for heroin addicts?
No, never methadone. But yes, that idea.
No, well, isn't that?
No, I use all kinds of stuff, but never another opiate.
But I thought that was common. No,
it is. It's bullshit. It's like, trust me. It's like I could get anybody off anything in 5 to 7 days.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. And pretty comfortable.
So there was a great reward for you to see these people sort of.
Well, no, I didn't know. I was doing the medical thing, and the whole time looking into those rooms with the 12 step on the wall, going, "What is that bullshit? That hocus pocus? You know what's going on there?" Then I followed some patients through treatment and watched them like grow. I couldn't believe it. And I was like, "What is this? So weird." I mean, I was used to patients going from acutely ill to chronically ill. You know, in medicine, that's sort of what you see a lot of. And this was, you know, astonishing to me that there was really something going on. So I just got more and more involved in it. And then I was asked to be an assistant director of a program, and then that director quit all of a sudden. All of a sudden, I was moved into the director position. I had to really train myself.
I was going to say, now you're not formally trained as a psychiatrist or a therapist, so would you have to go to additional
all sorts of continuing medical education and really pay attention and really.
Now it seems to me, you talked about being a cardiologist. If you treat me and I have a heart, and you treat me as well as you can, I haven't. My father died of heart attack, by the way. Everybody on his side dies of heart, so those are my choices, I guess. Cancer or heart disease. Literally, he had angina. Jesus. He wasn't supposed to be lifting heavy boxes.
Destined
he had
a for life or, comedy. Right.
And so it's like pick your poison. So that's if I die of a heart attack, nobody really points the finger at you unless you're a complete fuck up as a doctor. It's like, well, they did everything he could, and the guy, well, you know, they just had a bad heart and he died. When you treat addicts and they relapse or die of an overdose. Not, and I mean you in the third person, but maybe you more so because you've had...
It's closer to cancer.
It's like...
The model is closer to cancer.
Yeah, it's like they point the finger...
These are chronic, recurrent, deadly diseases that in spite of all best efforts, often are fatal.
But you, but it's unfair. There'd be times
I know
unfair,
what you're saying. You know, I, it drives me out of my mind.
Unfair to you.
You have no idea how painful it is when... In fact, it's so funny. I'm like dissociated just to saying this. I'm like flat, which is that when you go to do something good, you want to do good, you want to help people, and you do good, you think you're doing it, and then you're accused of doing bad. I can't imagine a more painful thing.
Yeah.
It's really an awful experience.
Well, one of the things that you, for me, you know, there's a lot of television and radio healthcare professionals, if you will, that sort of don't pass the litmus test for me and for a lot of people. But you do, because you never feel like you have any other skin in the game when I watch you or listen to you. And this is before I ever came on your show, and, you know, we've since, you know, kind of gotten to know each other and all of that. It's nothing to do with that. That I felt like, this guy's not bullshit. Like, I would listen to this guy. And I think that's probably why you connected with, on Loveline, with young people, because people may not be IQ smart, but what I've learned as a comedian is emotionally they're very, very smart, and they know when they're being bullshitted. Hmm. Like, my father was high school educated. My mother was high school educated. She's still alive.
But I had to learn that. because drug addicts bullshit me all the time, and I get pretty good at telling them. but they used to bullshit me all the time. That's kind of why, another reason I kind of got into it. Patients were like cleaning the floors with me.
Yeah,
I was so anxious to be good, do for them, whatever.
So
they
manipulate you.
Oh, they manipulate me. They call me in the middle of the night. Yeah, whatever you need. And they call like every night at 4 a.m. It's like, okay. You know.
So then you start laying down parameters.
Well, then I had to go to therapy to learn about boundaries, and I had to go do more training and stuff.
All right, that was Tommy Chong, Mick Foley, and Dr. Drew. Pretty cool, huh? I still can't find that document, by the way, on my computer. So now the screen's been punched, and it didn't punch back. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with those three dudes. And we got a great podcast coming up next week. And please, please go leave some comments that are nice and pleasant on iTunes for yours truly. See you next week.